Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Tit has come to tat, but push has not yet really come to shove in the Crimean sanctions squabble. There was news on that today. Also, drones as delivery devices, and the latest tech company IPO is your apartment. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 20th of March. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Well, it turns out Senator John McCain won't be vacationing in Siberia this spring. Speaker of the House John Boehner's ruble-denominated assets, if he has any, are now pretty much worthless, and neither of them seem to care all that much. The sanctions were flying fast and furious between Moscow and Washington today. Boehner, McCain, and seven others in the White House and in Congress were on the Russians list. President Obama has his own expanded list. Cronies, the White House said, of President Putin's have been sanctioned. Marketplace's David Gura is in Washington and on this story for us. Hey, David.
Hey, Kai.
Senator McCain and Speaker Boehner and all the others on this list are sort of making light of the whole thing. It's there's a little bit of tiptoeing around the edges going on here, right?
Yeah, tiptoeing via Twitter, if that's possible. That seems to be where it's all playing out, at least on the American side. But, you know, John McCain had some fun with this when he found out the Russians weren't interested in having him visit anytime soon. And the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Robert Menendez, did the same also on Twitter. So, you know, when it comes to sanctions, the U.S. doesn't seem to be casting a very wide net. It's targeting this. This list today has just about 20 names on it. And so, you know, the Obama administration is going after individuals, hoping that something's going to happen. And I think the Russians are trying to poke back as much as they can.
I wonder if what's going on here is something that we talked about 2 weeks ago in our Cold War special. The idea that what we have here 20 years after the Berlin Wall fell is this idea of mutually assured economic destruction, that we're all so intertwined now. The Russian economy is so much bigger and we're all so dependent that nobody really wants to do the really serious stuff.
Yeah, so, you know, economic sanctions are certainly not the only weapon that the U.S. has at its disposal, of course, or that U.S. allies have at their disposal either. But, you know, at least for the time being, it seems that sanctions are the weapon that we've decided to use to fight this. And I was talking with a guy today named Victor Comrys. He's a lawyer who works on sanctions-related issues and used to work in government. And he said that with Russia, as you're saying, you have to tread very carefully. And the reason for that is that, you know, that economy is so big and, as you said, so intertwined with economies around the world.
It's going to be very hard to find that sector of the Russian economy that's not going to have an impact also on its trading partners in Western Europe, in Asia, and around the world.
So, you know, that leaves the U.S. targeting these sanctions very narrowly, aiming almost exclusively here at what's really just a small group of President Putin's pals.
If they wanted to, not that they will, but if they wanted to, what might the White House be able to do that would really get the Russians' attention? Anything?
Well, you know, the administration could go after more banks. And on this list today, as I said, there are 20 individuals and one entity, and that's a bank. And that could have a wider effect. That casts a wider effect. It's less symbolic. Somebody told me today that the U.S. could create disincentives for investment in Crimea. But again, that'd be easier said than done. I talked to Simeon Kreisberg. He's another lawyer who specializes in sanctions. And we were talking about sort of what the best case might be here. If you look at this list, and it's not a very long list, but if you're a big business or maybe you work with Russian businesses or you work with folks who are sort of in that sphere of political figures in Russia, businessmen, businesswomen in Russia, you know, this list might give you some pause.
It has a chilling effect on commercial relationships that extend well beyond the specific targets that are announced.
So, you know, some of that symbolism would sort of erode a little bit. And, you know, Kreisberg told me that sanctions are the most effective, Kai, when it's not just one country imposing them. You know, it's when they're imposed multilaterally. That is, so when you can get other countries on board sort of backing the sanctions that you've made.
Which gets us to the Europeans, right? And one wonders whether the ball is next in their court, Chancellor Merkel and all the rest of them.
Yeah, and she's talking about this. I'd imagine that debate's going to continue just as it's going to continue here. But, you know, even just with pure geography, they're closer to all of this and what's happening there. And when you look at economic ties, I suppose you could argue that they feel a little more real for them there when they're depending on what's really just, you know, their neighbor for commodities and supplies.
David Gura in Washington on the sanctions story. More to come, I'm sure. David, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
Once again today, the markets couldn't care less who is sanctioning whom. And all that mean stuff I said yesterday about Fed Chair Janet Yellen and how the markets reacted, oh, forget about it. Wall Street got it all back today. And then some will have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama's on Ellen DeGeneres' show today. Why, you ask? Healthcare, of course. He's making the rounds to get as many people as he can to sign up for the Affordable Care Act before the deadline, which, as it happens, is the end of this month. This is just the latest stop of quite a few on the Obamacare barnstorming tour. Gone, it seems, are the days of the conventional presidential bully pulpit. From the Health Desk at the WHYY in Philadelphia Marketplace's Dane Gorenstein has that story.
Here's some ACA conventional wisdom. The more young and healthy people who sign up for insurance, the lower that keeps rates for everyone. The problem? It's widely believed not enough 18 to 34-year-olds have enrolled. So John Cohen with the brand strategy firm Innovation Protocol says if the president wants the young whippersnappers, podiums and speeches won't cut it.
I just don't think that that's going to connect with young people. I don't think that it's the way that young people are used to consuming information. I don't think they necessarily trust it when it comes that way.
What people trust, says Cohen, is a more personal touch. And that means the president showing up where they are, like today's appearance on Ellen.
Let's see if he's there. Michelle's husband, are you there?
I am here.
Now, here's the deal with these quick cameos. In exchange for a few minutes to talk up health insurance, President Obama has to deal with this.
You went to the Gap and you went shopping. How do you have time?
Well, here's the thing. We were on
and this from comedian Zach Galifianakis.
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously? What's it like for this to be the last time you ever talked to a president?
It's a bit unseemly for the president of the United States.
Whit Ayers runs the Republican polling firm North Star Opinion Research. He's helped market candidates for 30 years.
Answering some of the questions is hardly consistent with what we think of as dignity.
But Don Baer, head of Burson Marsteller and former President Clinton speechwriter, says all presidents leverage pop culture. This is just the latest vintage.
It would actually be remarkable in some ways if they weren't using those platforms and those channels and those programs. Why wouldn't you take advantage of that?
Here's the thing. The federal government's expected tab on promoting the ACA this year so far, $52 million. All these Ellen and Zach Galifianakis interviews, free. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The Washington Nationals got into a little bit of trouble with the Federal Aviation Administration a couple of weeks ago. They were using a drone to take aerial pictures of spring training, the kind of shots that are pretty much impossible for a regular non-flying human to capture. But still, the FAA said, nuh-uh, you can't do that. In fact, nobody can do anything commercial with drones until we say so. The FAA has since lost a round in court on that issue, but while they work on new regulations, there are loopholes and business opportunities to be had. Josh Ziering runs a San Francisco-based company called Quickie, which delivers pharmaceuticals via drone 24 hours a day for a drone surcharge of just a single dollar. Josh, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Tell me about this business. Your drone, you've got drones doing deliveries here?
I sure do. So Quickie is a pharmacy that is delivered via drone.
So how does it work? Somebody calls you and says, I need a prescription for amoxicillin. You verify that prescription somehow, and you slap it on a drone and zip away it goes?
Just like ordering an Uber, you're going to drop a pin, and then we're going to put a drone in the air right to you. And when it's outside, we're going to send you a message. And then you're going to swipe to drop. It'll drop your order on you, and it'll fly away.
It'll drop. What if I've got heavy pharmaceuticals that I need, man? Is it going to drop it gently?
We don't drop heavy pharmaceuticals.
All right. This is clearly the cutting edge of a lot of technologies. But aren't you worried that people are going to get concerned about all these things flying overhead?
We're worried about the public perception, but we think it's coming either way. And so we want to be right on the front leading edge of this.
And clearly you are. But what about, like, bicycles?
What about cars? What about schools? We have a lot of concerns, and we're working through that. The biggest problem with this is not technology, it's culture.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to interface high technology with culture. And so people are not going to immediately be okay with drones flying over them. We need to make them assured that our technology is the best and that we're going to be doing this in a responsible fashion.
Now, the FAA is opposed to commercially used drones in almost any context. Yes, they did just lose this court case, but I imagine you will have battles on your hands.
I agree, and I would describe myself as a troublemaker. And so, what we're going to do is we're going to cause as much trouble as possible until they're ready to create regulation and make this industry happen.
Is it just you in a walk up somewhere in the Mission, or do you have people working for you?
We have a small team of advisors and engineers, and we're working at a co-working space in the Mission. So, at any given moment, we have dogs, ping pong, and various people running around our office. It is complete chaos.
Sounds very startup-y.
It's very startup-y.
Yeah. What are you going to do if the FAA eventually gets its act together and comes out with rules for drones that get passed and certified and that you thus must abide by, and it says, yeah, I'm sorry, you can't do this?
We would love for the FAA to have regulations that allowed for drones, and if it unfortunately excluded us from those regulations, that would be tragic. But at the same time, the FAA is only for America, so there is literally an entire world of people that we can deliver things to.
Josh Ziering, his company is called Quickie. They do drone deliveries of pharmaceuticals up in San Francisco. Josh, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you.
Even though there was a good solid rainstorm here in California a couple of weeks ago, it was nowhere near enough to end the droughts that we are still smack in the middle of. So cities are trying to convince people to save water in all kinds of different ways. Los Angeles, for instance, will actually pay you money to rip up your front lawn. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more now on what some of those conservation efforts look like.
My yard is covered with gravel. Nice-ish landscaping gravel. I have a toddler who loves it. But it is not the prettiest yard in the world. The rosemary bushes and grasses along the edges help. But to be honest, it's a kind of low-water landscaping that gives non-lawn options a bad reputation.
I think that the biggest myth that should be dispelled is that native plant gardens are wild and ugly and look dead during part of the year.
Lily Singer is with the Theodore Payne Foundation for Wildflowers and Native Plants in Southern California. She says with drought-resistant natives,
beautiful gardens can be made.
Lush gardens with flowers. But it takes time for them to grow in, and it takes some work. You can't just pop a plant in the ground, done and done, and walk away.
When you first put in a drought-tolerant garden, it isn't drought-tolerant the day you put it in. These plants are coming from a nursery. They're little babies.
At Theodore Payne's nursery, garden designer Wynn Wilson looks at buckwheat, sage, and heuchera.
This is like a chocoholic in Candyland.
Wilson says low-impact gardens can be incredibly sophisticated. You have to think about the soil, the sun, the plants, the texture, the time of year they'll bloom, and how to get them water.
It's extremely important how we water these new gardens.
Modern irrigation systems have moved well beyond sprinklers on timers. They waste less water, and they've got a lot of moving parts. There are computers, ground sensors, even a 6-inch satellite dish that you put on your house that communicates with weather satellites about humidity and temperature.
Well, we just did a 2,000-square-foot front garden, completely new with the irrigation. We did all of our beautiful systems, and I would say that was approximately $3,500.
And that's just for the irrigation?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Great. But that includes the satellite?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, you get the satellite.
For $3,500, you get the satellite.
Yes.
Of course, you don't need a satellite or a $3,500 irrigation system to have a lovely drought-resistant garden. Just some knowledge about plants, a $10 garden hose, and the time to water them one by one. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up, where do you want to work? Wall Street or someplace else?
You could be a company man, and that is totally cool. Or you could maybe start your own company. Or you could maybe just try to make the world better.
So not Wall Street then? Nah, I'm just kidding. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 108 points today, 2/3%, closed at 16,331. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ advanced 11 points, 0.25%, ended things at 43.19. The S&P 500 also gained 11.6%, 18.72. Their financial shares fairly flew. J.P. Morgan Chase coursed up 3.1%, reaching its highest price in 14 years. Citigroup slicked up 2.6%. Bank of America counted a 2.75% gain. Today, Microsoft sweetened 2.7%. Analysts said the software company's upcoming office suite for Apple's iPad could bring in more than $1 million a year. Online data firm Teradata tore up 4.5% today. ConAgra Foods chomped up 1.3%. The company said its latest quarterly earnings nearly doubled, but apparel maker Guess shed 3.4% after making a worse-than-expected earnings forecast. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.77%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Friday. Jeweler Tiffany is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. Sid Vicious and Dracula are among his numerous glittering screen portrayals. Actor Gary Oldman turns 56. And on March 21, 1963, the infamous Alcatraz Penitentiary closed its doors. At any time, The Rock housed less than 1% of the total federal prison population. Today, more than 1 million tourists visit each year. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Airbnb is the corporate story of this Thursday, the company that lets you rent out your spare bedroom or your apartment to visiting French tourists or itinerant yoga teachers, perhaps. It's become enormously popular as a way for some people to save money and for other people to make money. And now the company wants some money. It's said to be in the early stages of an initial public offering at a valuation of as much as $10 billion, which is great. But Airbnb has had some unwelcome attention from regulators who say the whole thing is illegal. So really, wouldn't you want to clear all that up before you go public? Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that story.
Sean Ramaswamy used to rent out his room in Brooklyn on weekends.
I was doing it like every week, every other week.
To complete strangers, though mostly nice ones.
From the Midwest, from the West Coast, from Egypt, all over.
The problem for Sean and people like him around the country is that they could be breaking their leases or even the law. Fine if you're renting your room for $70, but what if you're selling an entire $10 billion company to the public?
Many cities have housing codes that would not permit you to turn your house into a B&B motel if you don't meet city codes.
Bill Caffey is with law firm White Summers, Caffey & James. He says the hotel industry will fight tooth and nail against Airbnb. But companies actually go public with this kind of pressure all the time. Patrick Fitzgerald is a serial entrepreneur and teaches at Wharton.
A good parallel example is oftentimes some companies go public even before they have FDA approval of a drug or a certain type of service in the pharmaceutical industry.
Airbnb is reportedly very profitable and still growing. And in fact, says attorney Bill Caffey, this might just be a great time to go public.
The market for IPOs is just red hot. You don't want to wait for a correction or a higher interest rate environment.
Plus, says Caffey, Airbnb has two points in its favor. One, it's actually clear how it makes money, unlike Instagram or WhatsApp. Two, it has lobbyists to push against laws that would render it illegal.
They're not making the mistake that the cell phone guys did for years and years by avoiding lobbyists and having the entrenched Ma Bells beat them up for decades.
And he says Airbnb has one last thing, a growing constituency of customers who enjoy the flexibility that Airbnb offers, but the hotel industry doesn't. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
It used to be that Wall Street got more than its fair share of the top-tier students from the top-tier schools. Banking in all its forms was quite a draw. Not so anymore, though. More and more of this country's best students are joining tech companies to seek their fortunes or choosing nonprofits as a way to improve others' fortunes in this world. Marketplace's Mark Garrison went to one of Wall Street's most storied hunting grounds, Princeton University, to find out what's going on.
So this is a place where I spend good amount of my time studying and just hanging out with my friends. It's composed of
senior Malik Jackson's really giving me a tour of his eating club. That's so, you know, very like Princeton thing. That's something of a combination frat house, dining hall, and pre-internet social network.
This is the dining hall.
Eating clubs are a key spot for bank recruiting. Wall Street loves hiring Ivy League athletes, and Jackson plays quarterback. That means there's a front row seat reserved for him on the train that has long carried Princeton grads to banking.
A lot of my friends are doing that. A lot of my teammates, a lot of my eating club members, a lot of my other classmates are going finance route.
But not him.
So in Jacksonville, I'm teaching middle school social studies.
Sorry, Wall Street. He's going back to his hometown via Teach for America. The growth in students going to nonprofits is a big change from years past.
I saw just about everyone headed to banks and consulting firms.
Wendy Kopp was at Princeton in the 80s. Seeing all the top students sucked into finance frustrated her. That inspired her to start Teach for America, the nonprofit which steers those undergrads to needy classrooms.
This is exactly what led me to think, like, we got to change this and figure out how do we get folks to channel their energy into education and social change.
Nonprofits got a big assist from Wall Street as banks blew up, cut jobs, and students questioned working for firms that wrecked the world's economy. Occupy Wall Street grew popular on campuses. When J.P. Morgan's recruiters came to Princeton in 2011, they got a bigger crowd than expected.
J.P. Morgan, change your actions, violate our motto.
Junior Damaris Miller was one of the Occupy protesters disrupting that recruiting session. We spoke outside the building where it happened.
When I was a freshman, a lot of my upperclassmen friends would tell me about how their friends were going into finance and consulting. And as I'm reaching those stages, I find that a lot of my friends are not.
45% of 2006 Princeton grads with full-time jobs worked in finance. But that number nosedived after the financial crisis. It hit just under a quarter last year.
I want to talk a little bit more about what I mean by control.
Figuring out what students want and how to get them there is the challenge for Poulin Sanghvi, who runs Princeton's Career Services Office.
They have a very, very strong instinct, as they should, to want to find work that has meaning as they personally define it.
Meaning can mean nonprofit, but not exclusively.
Upstairs is where our on-campus recruiting.
The day Sanghvi showed me around, Kayak was in town interviewing students. Tech companies and startups are scooping up many who might have gone to Wall Street.
Many of them are getting excited by the opportunity to disrupt industries and create new enterprises and build organizations that may create thousands of jobs.
Part of the reason banks had such a tight grip on elite schools for so long was their hefty recruiting budgets. Many students who weren't sure what to do just defaulted into finance.
Because their recruiting season is very early on, it's the first thing that people are exposed to. Everyone's just like, oh, maybe I should just apply.
Senior Eileen Lee comes from a banking family and is majoring in operations research and financial engineering. But the bank's pitch didn't sell her. And she says classmates are also looking beyond Wall Street.
Oh, so we're on the official calendar?
It should be on the official calendar.
Awesome.
Plenty still go there, of course. The ones who are most certain about it are here, an evening meeting of the Princeton Corporate Finance Club.
The website and industry insight, everything's good for that. We just need to get a list of advertisers.
Sophomore econ major Darwin Lee is president. Most undergrads do one finance internship after junior year. He did one straight out of high school. He's now deciding on his third.
This summer I'm looking at, you know, other places as well. I currently have an offer from a hedge fund that's going to be revolved around equity analysis.
Lee comes across as genuinely passionate about finance, someone going to Wall Street for the right reasons.
Growing up, I've been very numbers-oriented, competing in math competitions. I played chess, so every time, you know, a piece is taken or you're calculating, you know, the numbers, you know, what, how many points am I losing through this exchange? The thought process to accomplish those things is pretty much the same thought process used in a lot of financial fields.
Soon-to-be teacher Malik Jackson has no problem with friends going into finance, tech, or whatever, as long as they're following a passion, not just a routine.
You could be a company man. And that is totally cool. Or you could maybe start your own company. Or you could maybe just try to make the world better. Like, there's so many ways to do it.
Wall Street is freaked out about elite students passing it by. Banks are changing their recruiting pitch and work environments to compete. But it may be the students they can easily get are the ones who really want to do banking. That could be good for the banks. And it certainly seems good for the students. In Princeton, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which the NCAA basketball tournament comes up for what I'm guessing will be the last time. Much was made here and elsewhere of the billion-dollar bracket challenge from Warren Buffett and the founder of Quicken, whose name escapes me right now, actually. Anyway, thanks to the wonders of, you know, actually playing the game, it looks like the $1 billion is safe. No spoilers here, I promise, but after the games today, ESPN said just 5.7 of its 11 million brackets are still any good. So there you go. Me, as you might have guessed, I didn't play. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this, what, Thursday today. The Dow up 108 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ advanced 11 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 also gained 11 points. That is 0.6% on that index. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Margarita Noriega, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope we can see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.